Before we get started, I'd like to thank our patrons, Catherine VN, good name, Cherie Aberfield, Michelle Lawrence, Sarah Cook, Peter Dunn, Annie Ma, and of course, everybody else. Xavier Player, just noticed your name. That's a cool name. Thank you to all of our patrons. We've got some very cool stuff coming up, including a walking tour of Pentridge with a former guard and an online Ask Me Anything session with Narelle Fraser. So if you're not a patron yet, best you get to patreon.com/AustTrueCrime. That's A-U-S-T. Aust True Crime, and sign up for extra episodes and some events. I think it's going to be really cool and fun, and I'm looking forward to meeting you and talking to you and finding out what you want to know and what you would like more of and less of on our podcast, Australian True Crime. That link, of course, is on our Facebook page and my website and all over the place, so you don't have to remember it. Okay, on with the show.
So I went to his factory, pulled a gun on him, and then I ended up getting arrested a few days later and back to prison.
You might remember a couple of months ago, I spoke about visiting some Victorian prisons as part of the literacy programs run by the Friends of Castlemaine Library. One of the inmates who attended one of my sessions said on the day that when he was released, he'd look me up on social media and come on the podcast with me. I said I would love that. I don't think either of us believed the other really meant it on the day, but sure enough, I recently received a message through my website from Greg. And I'm so glad I did, because Greg knows more about the various tiers of the prison system, including youth detention and the problems with our parole system, than anyone I've ever met.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb.
Greg came to our studio with his mum, who you'll hear me refer to from time to time during this interview, because she was sitting right beside me. Although she never uttered a single word, her presence was very powerful. She's a small woman, beautifully groomed, shy and unassuming, but the pain she's endured is palpable. It weighs so heavily on her little shoulders, it seems to prevent her from grasping the hope her son desperately wants her to believe in just one more time. Theirs is a familiar Australian story in so many ways, but it's a story we rarely hear about from their perspective. Greg is ready to face up to a lot of stuff, but during the course of this conversation, he's going to help me face up to some stuff too, so stay tuned for that. First, though, we start by reminiscing about the day we met.
And which prison were you in?
Loddon.
You were in Loddon, that's right. Yeah, cool. I just really enjoyed that so much.
Yeah, it was good.
And I mean, I was aware at the time, I thought, oh, I know everyone's just here because they're so bored. So I didn't take it too seriously, but in terms of like that people had come to hear me speak. But then everyone was really generous and we had such great chat and, you know, like I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, no, definitely. It was good. Like all the guys there enjoyed it as well.
Yeah, great.
Yeah.
Do you get many people come to visit and chat, like talks and that?
Nah, that was maybe the first one.
Really?
From the whole 4 years that I was there.
Really? In 4 years?
Yeah.
They told me that the department, corrections department, kind of like changes its mind about whether things like that are good ideas or not.
Yeah. I think there was, because I spend most of my time at Port Phillip, but I think at Loddon maybe they do it every now and then, but the 6 months I was at Loddon, you were the only one that I know that came in.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I think there was this poet that was meant to come in, but he didn't.
Didn't. Can I use your real name or do you want to use a different name?
I can use my real name, yeah.
Just Greg?
Yeah.
Cool. Okay, so when you're at Port Phillip, is that a higher security jail? Is that different?
Yeah, so that's maximum security.
Oh, that's maximum, okay. Yeah. And Loddon is minimum or
medium?
Medium.
Yeah.
Okay, maximum security. So how are they different from your perspective in terms of your day-to-day kind of life?
Yeah, so they're very different in the sense that, like, Port Phillip, you're a lot more restricted with your movements. Mm. Like, Loddon, it's all open. You can go outside whenever you want, mix with the other units. Whereas Port Phillip, you're basically confined to that one unit, and it's you're only allowed out in the yard during certain times. You're locked down earlier. There's less stuff available to do, like less programs, less things education-wise.
And so when you say unit, like at Port Phillip, is that sort of like I'm picturing a building with your cells? I was going to call them bedrooms. Yeah. I'm such a dag. Sorry, your cells off sort of a main area.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
about you know maybe once at Port Phillip about 70 people, maybe 50 people actually.
Okay.
In the
how unit. Many to a cell?
So there's most of them have two people.
Okay.
And then there's ones with for one person, and at Port Phillip, each unit's got a couple that has three people in it.
And then there's this sort of common area in the middle.
Yeah, there's a little common area and a little, like, we call it a chook pen where you can go outside and, you know, walk laps, yeah.
Mm. And do you get any input into who you share a cell with?
Yeah, so when you first come in, they just put you with whoever, but then you can ask them to swap it around.
Mm.
Yeah.
Who'd you get put with initially? Or, like, you don't have to tell me their name, but, like, what sort of bloke was it? Were you happy with it or?
I can't even remember. Like, I've had that many, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, but, yeah, like, it was usually all right. Otherwise, yeah, I'd just change, go in with someone that I know.
How is it sharing a cell with a person? Like, that would shit me.
Yeah, it gets a bit much. Like,
yeah.
Especially even if you go in with a mate, eventually you're like, you're going to start hating each other. Like, yeah, it gets a bit to like, even just a little thing start to annoy you about each other.
Mm.
Yeah, especially when you're locked in a cell for a long period of time.
Yeah, just like zero private space.
Yeah, like, it's almost better to be with someone that you don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And is your toilet in there?
Yeah, toilet's in there.
That's no good.
Yeah.
It's not good, mate. No. I mean, how do you deal with that? Do you say, I'm sorry, I'm going to the toilet now? Or like, how do you?
Yeah, basically, like, yeah. I guess when you got to go, you got to go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man, that's harsh. Can I ask what you went to jail for?
Yeah, so I was charged with commercial trafficking,
okay,
of drugs and firearms,
mm-hmm.
and then ag burg as well,
mm-hmm.
aggravated burglary. Yeah.
Okay. So, what was the drug?
Ice.
Mm.
Yeah.
And were you using yourself?
Yeah. So I used to use a fair bit.
Mm-hmm. How old were you when you started using ice?
About 16. Yeah, I got into it just with a group of friends that I was hanging around. I guess just older guys that I used to look up to. Yeah. And from there, just snowballed, you know, into crime and staying up for days. Yeah, it wasn't good.
How does that happen? Like, how does it turn into crime? Is it to make the money to keep using?
I guess with me, it probably started even a bit earlier because I had a cousin that I used to look up to a lot. He was about 5 years older than me, and he'd gotten into all of that, you know, crime and drugs. And I remember when I was, you know, I would have been like really young, but I went out with him and he showed me how to shoplift and stuff like that. And so, you know, because I thought he was the best, you know, I thought he was so cool, I wanted to be like him.
Mm.
Then I started doing it with my mates, and yeah, not long after that, you know, he gave me my first drink, my first drugs, everything. And like, I don't blame anyone else for my own choices or anything like that. But yeah, that's basically where it started from. And, you know, that's the life I thought I wanted. And yeah, but like, it was already too late when I realised that, you know, what kind of a person he really was, you know. And I was already, you know, into that life and hanging around other people that were into that as well.
God, it's really, really hard, isn't it, when you're because your mum's here, so I'm looking at your mum. You don't have to talk, mama. But I just think to myself, God, it's how do you get through to your son, your little boy, when I can understand how cool that would look and how lame your mum looks when she's trying to say, no, no, that's not cool and you'll regret it later. And how do you persuade your son that that's not the way to go?
Yeah, it's hard because I think about that sometimes, like, because everything that my mum said to me has been 100% right.
I know, but...
but I had to figure it out on my own, like, so I think, like, now, like, you know, if a parent's got their kid going through that, like, what possible way of is there to get through to them? Like, if they're like me, you just don't want to listen, you know, you just block that all out.
Yeah.
And you think you know better, that you'll be all right. You know, you'll do it smart, and it just doesn't work.
Did your mum know that your cousin was such a bad influence?
Yeah, so all my family always would tell me to stay away from him. And so then I'd lie and say that I was with someone else. Yeah. Yeah, everyone always told me to stay away from him, you know? Yeah.
So what do we do? You know, do we pick up and move the whole family interstate because Greg won't stay away from his cousin? What do we do? What do we do? I guess we can't do that because we got jobs, we got lives, we can't. At some point we just have to.
Yeah, they try. Yeah, my parents tried heaps of different things and, I started, messing up at school, got kicked out of school a few times and... By that stage, I had a group of friends that was all doing the same sort of things as well. I guess we, encouraged each other to step it up and keep going. Mm. Yeah.
Oh, you're such a sweet... Look, I'm just looking at you now. You're such a lovely fellow. Gosh, it's breaking my heart now.
Thanks.
I can imagine what a cute little boy you were too. Horrible. Ah, I bet you weren't too cute when you were off your face, though, on ice.
No, it definitely wasn't.
Mm-mm. What sort of stuff was going on at home? How bad was your behaviour at home? How bad did it get?
Yeah, look, I'd just disappear for days, weeks at a time even.
Well, that's probably better, actually. Yeah. Honestly, isn't it? I mean, because we know that, meth behaviour can be pretty violent and pretty gross at home. We've heard of families... where the siblings are installing locks on their bedroom doors and stuff. So
I was never like that. I was never violent towards my family or anything like that.
Mm.
But I guess I just stayed away to deal with the guilt,
Yeah.
And then I'd come home and then just crash out and sleep for a couple of days and then be off again.
Mm.
Yeah, and then, I started getting in trouble with the police, getting locked up. And then it was always, my parents that would be there, my mum would always be there. I'd get out, go back to my friends.
Yeah. Now, your mum was not born in Australia?
No, so, my parents, both from Russia.
Mm-hmm.
My mum came to Australia when she was pregnant with me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, to give me a better life.
Yeah. And so, of course, I'm hearing, echoes of stories I hear and talk about now about kids from African families.
Yeah.
And about their parents working so hard.
Yeah, definitely.
To make lives for them and them just being so naughty.
Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. And were your parents saying all of that to you, I guess, that, they didn't bring you here for this and they're working so hard and...
Oh, 100%. Like, they killed themselves working flat out to put me through good schools and, to try to give me good opportunities. And, I just wasted it all. Like, I wasn't interested. Yeah. No, it's... Like, I look back now at it all and regret it. But, yeah, back then I just didn't think about it.
I mean, I guess, did it make you feel, how did you feel when you were, rattling around with these other guys and committing crime, taking drugs, being picked up by the cops? Did it feel, you tell me, what was the feeling of that, being that guy?
Like when I was young, I thought that was cool, you know, like I thought that's going to make me look cool, you know, it's, you know, impress people.
Mm.
Now I think it's bloody ridiculous, you know, like
yeah.
what's cool about being arrested by the police is...
Yeah.
It's embarrassing.
But I assume it would feel powerful. Would that be a word you would associate with it?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
100%.
Tough.
Yeah, you feel tough. You feel like you're the man, you know? Like you've got money, you can get yourself whatever you want. But you're not happy, you know? Like you're definitely not happy.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't anyway.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. So do you think like you were self-medicating a bit too? Do you think like you were happy when you're on drugs?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. When did you first start participating in major crime? When did the arrests get serious?
The arrests got pretty serious. Like they were pretty serious even back then when I was 16, 17, like, you know, for serious assaults. I got arrested for trafficking, small amount back then. And then, like, when I turned 18, like 2 weeks after my birthday, I was at the MAP, so the Melbourne Assessment Prison.
That's a remand centre?
Yeah, remand.
Yeah.
And I was terrified, like, I'll be honest.
Was that your first time
in adult prison, yeah. So, you know, and then the police were scaring me as well, you know, saying that, you know, people get raped there and stuff like that. You know, you only see what you see in the movies.
Mm.
So, yeah, I was pretty nervous going in there. But then, you know, I was there for a couple of weeks and I got out on bail. And then at that time I actually stayed off the drugs for a few months, but I was drinking a bit. Mm. So, and I was just getting into trouble anyway with getting into fights and stuff. So then... Yeah, a few months after that, I went in for my first sentence, which ended up being about a year and a half.
Ooh.
But most of that was at a youth training centre in Malmesbury for 18 to 21-year-olds.
Mm.
So it wasn't too bad. And, yeah, I got out.
Well, now, hang on, before we move past Malmesbury.
Yeah, sorry.
And it being not too bad, I mean... The idea that Malmesbury is not too bad is controversial because a lot of people think it's not bad enough.
Yeah.
You know, like a lot of people think that youth detention in Australia is mollycoddling, kids get spoiled, they're rioting, so people give them pizza to make them quiet, you know, that we're spoiling kids in youth detention. But then I'm also aware that, you know, previous to this, in the past, youth detention boys' homes were hellscapes.
Yeah.
Where boys were sexually assaulted, you know, physically assaulted. They were hideous and they turned out lunatics. So can you tell us about Malmesbury? What is youth detention like?
Well, I personally think, like, that what they do at Malmesbury is pretty good, pretty important.
Okay.
Because I came out of there with some good opportunities, you know, and feeling pretty good about myself in a sense that, like, you know, they treat you with respect there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they paid for me to get, you know, a qualification, and they got me a job and everything. And I was actually going pretty well for not very long, for the first few weeks when I got out of there.
Okay.
You know, they got me a job working at a gym. They got me my Cert 3 and 4 in health and fitness. And, like, if people – they do give people a chance. And from what I've noticed is a lot of the people that I was with in Malmesbury, I didn't see them again throughout the system.
Okay. Wow. That's a good endorsement.
Whereas people that I've met in prison, I've seen them all come back through nearly, you know?
Okay.
Yeah. So –
that's an excellent endorsement.
Like, yeah, obviously a lot of people that go through Malmesbury do go on to go to prison.
Yeah.
But there's, I think, a lot less than the ones that go to prison straight away.
Yeah, because you're saying that, so in prison there isn't that stuff. In prison there aren't the programs to try and help you better yourself.
Not to that extent. Okay. And they don't encourage it like they do at Malmesbury, you know? Okay. Yeah, there you in prison. You got to battle if you want to get a qualification or some sort.
Yeah, in big boy jail, there's none of this really pushing you to try.
No, not at all.
Get you to engage with the program.
Not at all. They'd rather you go work in the factory.
Yeah.
And make the prison money.
Yeah. I did two sessions that day. I met you. Were you in the one where the man who was about in his 50s said to me, "I can't read"? Were you in that one? You might have been the other one.
I'm not sure.
We were chatting about what are you reading right now? And I said to a man, "What are you reading right now?" And he said, "I can't read."
Yeah.
And I was shocked to the back teeth. I don't know why. I shouldn't have been, but I just thought, where else would you end up then?
Yeah, 100%. Like, you meet a lot of people in there, like adults that can't read and write.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really, I couldn't imagine going through life like that. Like, it would be that so hard.
Yeah. It's unbelievable, isn't it? And I would have assumed that in jail someone would have caught that man and pushed him into a program and helped him learn to read.
Yeah, well, and a lot of these people, like the prison knows that they can't read because, you know, they ask you when you come in and they'll tell themselves it'll be on their file. But then it's up to them if they want to chase it up and if they want to learn how to read. The prison won't really push it. And
Okay, so after Malmesbury, is that when you went to Port Phillip?
No, I've been in a few times.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, sorry, I'm forgetting that. This is the first trip.
Yeah.
Okay, so after you got out of Malmesbury, you kept it together for a little while.
Yeah, not for long.
That's okay. But it's a journey, man. Yeah. It's a journey, yeah.
But I wasn't as bad as what I was before and what I would become later, you know? Like,
okay.
So I went through a period where, you know, I was working and, I wasn't committing crimes, but I was still using drugs a bit.
Mm-hmm. Was it annoying to be earning so little money for working so hard?
Yeah, definitely. It was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've heard that many, many times.
Yeah. Mm. That time I was out for about a year and a half before going back in for 6 months, and that time it was a full adult sentence. So, but it was done mainly at Loddon.
Okay. So medium security. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so I did that, and then when I got out from Loddon, I jumped straight into dealing drugs and, you know, living that sort of life.
Why was that? Do you think that might have been because Loddon wasn't really a deterrent? Did you just sort of come out thinking, oh, that's fine?
Yeah, basically, like, you know, the 6 months I did at Loddon, it wasn't really a deterrent.
I can wear a tracksuit and do that.
Yeah, you know, you just don't, it's just boring. Like, that's it.
Got a microwave and I can go in there and eat noodles for six. That's fine. Yeah?
Basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, yeah, when I got out that time, I jumped straight back on the drugs, dealing the drugs, and yeah, like I went deeper into that whole world than I had been before, and so that went for a while.
Where's your self-esteem at by this stage? Like, what are you thinking about yourself? And when you're looking at your mum and your dad and, you know, how are you feeling about your life and yourself?
Well, it's funny you say that because I actually remember back then thinking that I was better on the drugs, you know? Like, I thought people will like me more, that I'm more fun to be around, you know? And
But, I mean, that's amphetamines. That's what they're for. Yeah.
Yeah.
I used to take amphetamines in my teens as well. I mean, that's what they're for because they make you think. They make you feel good about yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, look, and I guess just because when I was a kid, I guess I had a pretty low self-esteem. So maybe it came from that a bit as well. But, yeah, back then, you know, it gave me confidence.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had all these people around me all the time. You know, I realise now that they were just there for the drugs.
Yeah.
But, yeah. It felt good at the time, I guess. But, then especially back then I'd disappear from my family for ridiculous amounts of time. Like they'd be trying to call me, trying to reach me.
Yeah.
And I just wouldn't deal with it.
well, just stay away because, you know, they're not going to make you feel good. They're not going to like what they see. Yeah. So.
Yeah. And I just, I'll try not to think about what they'd be going through. Like, yeah, I put them through hell. Like, I remember I missed my mum's 50th birthday, which was like she was opening a restaurant as well, like, because I fell asleep. Yeah, like, missed out on a lot of things.
Mm.
But.
So was this around the time of the aggravated burglary? Was that during this period?
So the aggravated burglary happened in 2015 mm-hmm. while I was on bail for the commercial trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How much was the commercial trafficking? What was the amount?
Half a kilo of ice.
Okay. It's a substantial amount.
Yeah.
Yep. And so while you were on bail,
yeah,
what were you thinking?
Yeah, I definitely wasn't, like, because what happened was I lost my sister in 2014 to cancer.
Yeah, so about 20 minutes into our conversation, Greg finally gets around to mentioning the tragic loss of his sister to cancer. Of course, it was a massive blow to him and to his family. And her illness played a big part in his self-destructive behaviour. We'll delve further into that after the break. Coming up on Australian True Crime, Greg blows my mind with his perspective on our parole system. But first, we talk about the availability of drugs in Australian prisons and the effects of family trauma on Greg's criminal career.
I lost my sister in 2014 to cancer.
Oh, that's terrible. Was she older or younger?
She's older. And then my house got raided 2 days later, and that's when they found the drugs.
And I mean, the other thing about meth is it just fries your nervous system and your, you know, so you're completely, you know, frazzled.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
And then you have this terrible tragedy.
Yeah.
And then you're raided.
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, I was dealing with a lot that week and dealing with huge guilt of getting locked up, like, because I wasn't home when they raided, so I actually handed myself in a week later. But, yeah, I was dealing with, you know, the guilt of leaving my mum now with no kids.
Mm-hmm. And putting your mum through.
And putting her through hell, yeah.
Hell while she's dealing with your sister's
illness. That's right.
Yeah.
So when I got locked up for that, I got out on bail 6 months later, and I guess because in jail you don't deal with anything that's going on outside, because you're just in a bubble there. And when I got out, I guess I really started to sink in more, and I started to see, you know, how everyone had been affected. And yeah, I got back on the drugs. I was really angry. Just, and I was looking for somewhere to direct that anger at, and that's, I guess, where the aggravated burglary idea happened. So
who was it that you?
It was another drug dealer. Yeah, so I went to his factory, and his mate was there. It wasn't him. I pulled a gun on him, and you know, he ended up running off, and then I ended up getting arrested a few days later and back to prison. Yeah.
Do you think you wanted to go back to prison because it is that bubble where you don't have to deal with anything?
I don't know, but maybe on some level, but I just remember, like, a few weeks later when I snapped out of it a bit, just thinking back to that period of time whilst I was on bail and thinking, what the hell was wrong with me? Like, I've never felt like that in my life. Like, it just felt like that wasn't even me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, even though I've been on drugs and done a lot of things in the past, for just that period of time, the way I was thinking, the things I was doing and saying, it just wasn't me. And, yeah. But I guess everything happens for a reason.
Well, also you're a drug addict.
Yeah.
So, I mean, did you get any treatment at any stage during this process? Like in Malmesbury or anywhere, did anyone offer you treatment for your drug addiction?
Yeah, look, when I'd, during the, like the, when I was under 18 during the youth justice times, they put me in with a counsellor, but I just tell them what I think they want to hear. You know, I wasn't taking it seriously. And the same thing with, like, when I was on parole previously, you know, I'd tell them, no, I've been using drugs, this, that, when I was off my head, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then, yeah, just, if you know, if you don't want it yourself, you're not going to get anywhere.
So then you went back to jail, I guess, back to Port Phillip?
Yeah, so MRC Port Phillip. MRC is the same, it's maximum. But
how are your mum and dad coping by this stage?
Yeah, so not too great, like the shadow, but I'm very lucky in a sense that, you know, my parents, they've always been there for me. Like, doesn't matter how many times I've stuffed up. Like, I've seen other people in there whose parents have just had enough of them, and the family, they'll have nothing to do with them.
It's amazing, isn't it? You see some people whose parents will kick them out at 14 for nothing. Isn't it incredible?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and then you think of your parents who will just never, ever turn on you. It is amazing. So even through their own grief and heartache, they just never let you down.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, look, especially those first few months after my sister died, like, it was hard. I couldn't even, like, every time I'd even go to call my mum, I'd start to tear up, and, you know, you don't want to cry in front of anyone there. So, like, I tried to, like, hide it, and, yeah, it was tough times.
Did you tell anyone there? I mean, do you, you know, do you tell people in prison stuff like that?
Yeah, like, I told my mates there, like, I told people I know what had happened. But everyone there's got their problems.
Everyone's got their problems in prison, right? Can you access counselling in there?
Yeah, so it's hard, but you can. And I did about last year.
So. Okay, so you were in there a while before you did?
Yeah.
And also, are you then cleaning up? I mean, can you access drugs in there, or are you within a couple of days of being going into prison, are you clean?
No, there's heaps of drugs in prison.
Okay, right.
Yeah, so for the first couple of years, a few years, I was using drugs flat out in there.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. I was probably maybe 18 months ago that I stopped.
Oh, God, yeah. I'm such an idiot. I always thought that was one of the great benefits of going to jail with an addiction. I mean, I always knew there were drugs, but I always thought surely at least for the first little while you'd be clean. It'd take you a little while to get drugs, and I just thought, oh, well, at least you'll be clean. You'll clean up and you'll have a chance, but nah.
Nah, not really, like.
Right.
Yeah, like, but the thing with there, like, there'll be maybe stages, so there'll be drugs there, and then it'll run out, and then there might be a few weeks or something where there's nothing. But
then it'll be flooded.
Yeah.
And then when it's there, as if you're not going to use, when it's right in front of you. And
well, let's see. Like, if someone wants to use drugs, being in prison is not going to stop them.
Nah.
Yeah.
So how did you stop using in that environment?
So, I don't know. Like, with me, it was, like, I was at a really low point. I'd been put in the slot.
What's that?
So, like, a management unit. So it's like a punishment unit.
How come?
For getting involved in drugs, for allegations of it. Yeah. And so I was in there. I remember I was thinking about my sister heaps. And then, like, I started exercising because I got really, really fat in there.
Do you think you were thinking about your sister because you were withdrawing?
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was coming up to the time of the anniversary of her death. And
oh God, how intense. So you're in the slot.
Yeah.
You're withdrawing.
Yeah.
Sister's anniversary is coming up. You're fat.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, that's so intense emotionally.
Yeah, it was tough times. And then because I'd always like, because I remember when I got out on bail, my mum asked me if we could go to my sister's grave and I'd make the promise that I won't use drugs again. And I said no, like, because I wasn't ready.
Yeah.
But around this time, I made that promise. Like, and at first I did it gradually. Like, first I'd do it for, I'd say, because I remember one time I noticed the drugs had come into the unit and I was thinking, oh, should I, shouldn't I? And I go, I made the promise. I go, I'm not going to do it today.
Yeah. Great plan. That's what I'm a big believer in that. Don't say forever, just say today.
And it was like magic. Like, I'd gone from getting like anxious thinking about it to suddenly it was no longer an option.
Mm.
And it just fully went away. Like, it just, it was not, I wouldn't even consider it. And I was shocked, like, how it just transformed, you know, straight away. So then a few days later, I was thinking about it, and then I said, all right, till the end of my sentence.
Mm.
And then, like, a couple of days after that, I've made the promise. I'm like, nah, it's for good, you know? Like,
wow, great.
Because I don't need it. And now in my head, it's not even an option.
Great.
And, like, because I was exercising then and training as well and starting to see results, it made me feel confident and good about myself too.
Yeah. And then you start getting those endorphins and those natural.
Definitely.
Yeah, highs.
And then, like, but yeah, it's like ever since I've made that promise, it almost trips me out, like, how easy it's been for me. Like, because I was still around it all in there. And, you know, like, I'd be there and my mates would go have it. And I'd just leave the room, like, because I just don't want it. And then everyone would be like, wow, you know, they'd tell me, you know, they're impressed with me and that would make me feel good about myself too.
And good on them, because sometimes other users, you know, feel bad about themselves because you're doing it, you're actually staying clean and they can't stand it and they want to drag you back down.
Yeah, so there's people like that there too.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're like, oh, come on, you know.
Yeah.
Like, but no, like, I have a couple of genuine mates there.
Good on them.
Yeah, they were pretty good.
Mm.
Yeah, so.
And now explain to me, that day that we met, you were the person who piped up and you started talking to me about parole because you were explaining to me that you had actually been granted parole a full year before that.
No, I wasn't granted. I'd been eligible for parole a year before that.
But you were saying to me that since Adrian Bailey killed Jill Maher, it had been virtually impossible for people to get parole. Now, as I said to you, I'm one of the people who marched and screamed to the high heavens about the fact that he was out of jail because he'd raped and assaulted so many women.
Yeah.
And we were like, how is this thing out of jail to rape and kill another woman? And because he was on parole, I thought.
Yeah.
So now explain to me what happened.
So, like, 100% I agree that Adrian Bailey is a scumbag and deserves
of course
to be there. And it's really, really sad what happened what happened to Jill Maher.
Mm.
But the fact that he was on parole, like, had he not been on parole, had he finished his whole sentence, he still would have gotten out and done that.
And killed someone, absolutely.
Killed someone.
You're right. Yeah.
And maybe he would have been even longer before he got caught because he wouldn't have been supervised or anything like that.
Excellent point.
But when all this happened, all the focus got turned on the parole system.
And it becomes a really sort of easy win for our politicians to say,
definitely.
Okay, look at us, we're heroes, we're tightening up the parole system.
That's right.
Rather than change sentencing for someone like him, they tighten up the parole system. So what has that done for people like you?
Well, it makes it so difficult to get parole. Like, before Adrian Bailey, if it was your first time in prison and the judge gave you, let's say, 6 months on the bottom and 12 months on the top, so that means 6 months and then 6 months parole, you'd get out after 6 months on parole.
Mm.
But now you're guaranteed not to get out on that day anymore. Now it's a long process, very difficult. I had a 2 years, 9 month parole period. I didn't even hear from corrections until after my earliest, you know, the earliest is your parole date, like the earliest you're eligible to get let out.
Yeah.
And like, I don't blame the parole board or anything like that either, because they got so much pressure on them from the media.
People like me.
Yeah.
That's okay. No, I understand. Yes.
But that's because I guess that's what so, you know, that's what makes headlines, you know, that's what really plucks at, you know, the public's heartstrings and stuff is, you know, you put this on the news and you blame the parole board when it's not the parole board at all. Like, it's really hard to put a number on how many crimes are avoided because people are on parole. You know what I mean? You can easily count how many times someone commits a crime on parole. But, yeah, like, it's...
Greg, I just think that is such an excellent point. Yes, you're right. You're absolutely right. And, yeah, I take it on board. I think you're absolutely right. And I'm so glad you know, because on that day, and I said to you, please look me up when you get out.
Yeah.
And I was so glad you did, because I think that's a really good point that I didn't understand. I think you're right.
Thanks.
Yeah.
But it is, because, like, when you're on parole, especially the first 3 months, you got to go twice a week to see your parole officer.
Mm.
You got to do a minimum of, I think, two urine tests,
mm-hmm.
and which are random, so you don't know when they're coming.
Mm-hmm.
Then you get assessed to see a drug and alcohol counsellor. You have to, like, you have a curfew. Like, I've got two ankle bracelets on. You know, one is to make sure that I'm home between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m.,
mm-hmm.
another one to make sure I don't drink alcohol. So there's all these conditions in place, which obviously, over time, if you're doing the right thing, they get gradually, you know, a bit easier.
Mm-hmm.
But all these things are there to monitor people in my situation, you know, on parole, whereas... Had I been forced to do my whole sentence, or someone else is, you know, forced to do their whole sentence, whether it be an extra year, extra 6 months, extra couple of years, whatever, then they get out to absolutely nothing with no house to live in or anything, because to get parole, you have to have an address. But these people, if they don't have a house, they're just told to stay in jail for a bit longer, then they get out into the street. Well, of course they're going to go back to committing crimes and stuff like that.
So there's no gradual transition. So what you're going through is a transition. You're staying with your mum.
Yeah.
You're monitored. It's more gradual.
Gosh, definitely.
That's so interesting. And, I mean, we should make the point that Adrian Bailey was absolutely in the frame for Jill Maher's murder within, I would say, 24 to 36 hours of having committed it. And part of that is because he was so closely monitored.
That's
right. So, I mean, you make some really excellent points.
Yeah, look, honestly, I think it's much better for the community to have more people let out on parole rather than with nothing at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, because...
Because prison is such a different environment from 100%. The world. So to go straight from that to back into...
100%.
Into the straight world is really weird when you think about it.
Yeah, definitely.
Isn't it?
Like, it took me, like, I've only been out for 6 weeks, and like I told you before, I'd have already made the decision to quit drugs and all that. So I was fine in that sense. But even just getting out from spending all that time in there, it was difficult. Like, it wasn't that easy. Like,
How has it been?
It's been weird. Like, the first few weeks, like, I didn't really want to leave the house much. Like, my confidence was really low. Yeah, it was weird. Like, I've only just started to really come back to myself in the last couple of weeks. But
like, why is it weird? Is it scary to be out in the street? Is it noisy? Is it, like, what do you notice when you're out and about?
I don't know, like, you think, like, people looking at you, like, are people judging you, sort of thing. And because you're just not used to it. Like, you're used to being in prison where, you know, if you're walking around, like, something that I noticed, which was weird, like, I wasn't used to people looking at me and smiling.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it was just a weird thing, you know? Like, people, it's just, little things like that you notice.
Are you scared people will notice your ankle bracelets?
Yeah, so I don't like leaving the house in shorts. And we're coming up to summer now. So, like, on some hot days, like, even I've just worn shorts just to go down to the shops quickly, and I feel like I'm getting weird looks and stuff like that. Or when I go to the gym, I've bought socks. I've bought longer socks now that I wear over them, but you can still notice the bulge.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was just, yeah, it definitely feels uncomfortable.
Yeah, because you're a built dude.
Yeah.
And you got your cap on, but you're still bald.
Yeah, still bald, yeah.
And with two ankle monitors on, you could look potentially scary at the gym.
Well, definitely.
Yeah, yeah. Like I might think, Jesus.
Yeah.
You know, if I didn't know you, might think this guy's intimidating. So, yeah, and you're not. You're a very sweet person. So
thanks.
I can get how that would, for you, that might think, what are people thinking?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
But now you've got a job?
Yeah, so I've got a job start Monday.
I mean, how is that process trying to... I've spoken to former prisoners before and I know that's a shit of a thing trying to get a job.
Yeah.
Do you get any assistance at all? Is there a place that helps former prisoners get jobs?
I was very lucky in the sense that my mum's organised this job for me through a family friend.
Yeah.
But like I was saying before, a lot of people don't have the support that I do.
Yeah.
And I guess the only help that they get with getting the job be mainly through Centrelink.
Yeah.
I think there are organisations, I remember when I was younger, that help prisoners get jobs. Like I was saying before, when I left Malmesbury, it was the Bridge Project that helped me get that job, through the YMCA. But I think Toll does something where they hire people from prison. I don't know if they still do, but they did at one stage. But
are you excited about starting your job?
Yeah, definitely. Like, I'm actually really looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Because it'll be something that'll help me feel normal and maybe, you know, get some regular income coming in. Yeah. That'd be good.
I know. How old are you now?
I'll be 29 this month.
I mean, you have never lived a normal life yet.
No, I really haven't, yeah.
You know, you haven't lived in your own place, had a job.
Yeah, like I live in my own place.
Now?
Yeah, but I'm lucky there that, you know, there's something else that mom's given me. Yeah.
Okay, but you haven't, you know.
Yeah. No, definitely, I haven't kept to a proper routine.
Have you had a relationship?
Yeah, I've had in the past all my relationships have been basically drug relationships.
Around drugs, that's right.
But, you know, I started seeing this girl now.
Have you? Yeah. Oh, how wonderful.
Yeah.
Wow.
But it's only early days, but, yeah.
I know, but it really feels like this new, mum looks, you look tentative. I'm not going to ask you to speak, but, you know, happy, but, yeah, I mean, it feels like this very new world.
No, 100%. And like, it feels good just to know that, you know, I've got my mum's trust back.
Great.
You know, because for years no one could rely on me for anything. You know, I'd say I'll come see them on this day and then I wouldn't, or I'd tell them I'm doing well and then I'd be back in prison. But I can feel like that my mum's starting to trust me again, which feels good.
Do you keep in touch with mates in prison?
Yeah, like I've got a couple of mates that have put me on the phone, but I don't know, they call very rarely. But
it's a tricky one, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because I know my mum's having a big breath because the advice will be
no, but it's they're positive people. Like,
yeah, I know.
Yeah.
I know, but I know the advice will be don't.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you feel like a bit of an asshole because in prison, they were such a great support and a positive support. So I know that's always a really tricky one.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, it's a journey, mate. I keep saying, you know, and you got to trust your own judgment and you're a grown up.
No, definitely.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
And I believe in you.
Thanks.
And thank you so much for getting in touch with me and for being friendly that day when I came in. And congratulations, Mama. Got your boy back. It's very exciting.
Thank you.
And stay in touch, please.
100%.
There will definitely be an update on Greg for our patrons in a couple of months. I can't wait to see how he's going. I want to ring him right now and ask how he's going, but I think I should give him a bit more time, don't you? Thank you so much for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime, and thank you to all of our patrons.